WMRA News. I'm Bob Levicky. A crowd gathers in Harrisonburg to remember those killed by ICE, joining protests around Virginia and the U.S. Text messages from UVA's Board of Visitors show unusually close coordination with Governor Youngkin and contempt for former President Ryan. And Virginia's new governor will have a role to play if the General Assembly passes a constitutional amendment for redistricting. This is the WMRA Daily for Monday, January 12th. A crowd gathered in Harrisonburg on Friday evening to hold a vigil for people killed by U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement. WMRA's Randy B. Hagee reports.
People fill the courthouse's southern lawn down to the sidewalk, singing in remembrance of Renee Good, three others shot and killed by federal immigration officers in recent months, and 32 people who died in ICE custody last year. One of Friday's speakers read out each of their names, and attendees responded with the Spanish word for present.
Silverio Villegas González.
Paloma Salcedo, a longtime immigrant rights activist, told those gathered to trust their eyes.
Renee Good, a Minneapolis mother of three, did not die in a tragic accident. We're not here because of a tragedy. We are here because we are being murdered by ICE. There is no official statement, no carefully worded, re-edited press release, no retold, reconstructed narrative that can wash away her blood or the blood of the countless others killed or disappeared by this system.
Another speaker, Jeremy Aldrich, told WMRA after the vigil that Harrisonburg is a community where people show up for one another.
There's a real sense of fear, powerlessness, hurt, and grief. And so we came together tonight to share that, to be present with each other, and to explore ways to turn our grief into something hopeful.
According to NPR, this vigil was one of more than 1,000 events held across the country this weekend, protesting ICE in the wake of Renee Good's killing in Minneapolis. For WMRA News, I'm Randy B. Hagee.
You can see a photo of the vigil and links to more information at WMRA.org and on our app. Text messages by some members of the Board of Visitors at the University of Virginia over the past year and a half show frequent coordination with Governor Glenn Youngkin. An analysis of texts obtained by the Washington Post show that some conservative appointees to the board expressed inflammatory views of UVA's diversity policies and its then president, James E. Ryan. At times, the texts show tension between conservative, moderate, and more liberal board members, including one who referred to his fellow board members as, quote, crazies. The messages were obtained through Virginia's Freedom of Information Act by Richmond-based author Jeff Thomas and provided to the Post. Former board members say the texts suggest a degree of involvement by the governor's administration in university operations that is not typical in modern Virginia history. Ryan resigned under pressure last June, despite pleas by Governor-elect Abigail Spanberger to wait on selecting his replacement. The board voted to hire Scott C. Beardsley, formerly the dean of UVA's Darden School of Business, as UVA's president, effective January 1st. It is influenza season, and the contagious respiratory disease is reaching record highs nationwide. The U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention reported during the week of January 3rd that roughly 40,000 people were admitted to hospitals with the flu. In Virginia, during that same time period, about 4,000 people tested positive for the virus. The State Department of Health recommends flu-positive people stay home until both their symptoms have improved and there is no fever for at least 24 hours. Governor-elect Abigail Spanberger takes office Saturday, shortly after Democrats in Virginia's legislature are expected to pass a mid-decade redistricting amendment. The timing required for the proposed redraw to have any impact will require the governor-elect, who is lukewarm on the concept, to act. Virginia Public Radio's Brad Kuttner reports.
No, but will.
That's Governor-elect Abigail Spanberger in December when asked if she thought mid-cycle redistricting was the way to go for Virginia. Speaking to Politico, the incoming governor clarified her tepid response by saying it will be up to the people via ballot referendum. And while Virginia's constitutional amendment process is usually outside the governor's purview, UVA Center for Politics scholar Jeff Shapiro said the timing required for mid-cycle redistricting, specifically a referendum in the spring, will require action from the executive.
To put that matter before the electorate requires adopting a statute, a piece of law, and it would have to be signed by the governor.
There's also funding for that spring referendum, her approval of the maps themselves, and some statutory requirements in the map drawing process that could require legislative approval. Such action could be among Spanberger's first responsibilities after taking office, and while her 15-point win may speak to Virginians' support for her, other forces could play in the process, according to political analyst Bob Holdsworth.
Democrats in her party are really pushing it, the people she needs to push her own agenda. But at the same time, I think she recognizes that if there's a 10-1 map, this is going to really poison even further than they might currently be potential relationships with the Trump administration right away.
The Virginia legislature is expected to take up the redistricting amendment when the 2026 session starts next week. In Richmond, I'm Brad Kuttner.
One of the items on the affordability agenda for Virginia Democrats this year is the Equal Pay Act. Virginia Public Radio's Michael Pope explains.
Preventing employers from asking about salary history for potential hires has been a goal for State Senator Jennifer Boysko for years. In session after session, the Democrat from Herndon has tried and failed to pass what she calls the Equal Pay Act.
When I first started carrying this in 2017, they said it would be too difficult, and I respond, what's difficult is not being able to be paid as much as you're worth.
Republican Governor Glenn Youngkin vetoed Boysko's bill not once, but twice. Now, Virginia is about to have a new governor, and Delegate Michelle Maldonado, a Democrat from Manassas Park, says she's hopeful Abigail Spanberger will sign the bill.
It does fall very nicely into our affordability plans about how we're trying to make things affordable for everyday folks. And certainly, having good salaries, good compensation and benefits packages falls right into that for people to be able to care for themselves and for their families.
According to the National Women's Law Center, women in Virginia earn 74 cents on the dollar compared to men. I'm Michael Pope.
State Senator Adam Eben of Alexandria will resign from the General Assembly next month to become a senior advisor for Virginia's Cannabis Control Authority. WAMU's Margaret Barthel has more.
Setting up a legal cannabis marketplace in Virginia, a goal that has eluded Democratic lawmakers, will be a major issue in the upcoming legislative session. Eben previously led the effort to decriminalize cannabis for adults. He has also been a key voice on gun safety legislation, metro funding, and LGBTQ rights. He's the first openly gay person to serve in the Virginia legislature. Eben's departure midway through the legislative session will touch off another special election process for a safe Democratic seat in Northern Virginia, where several lawmakers have left for roles in the Spanberger administration. Delegate Elizabeth Bennett Parker and former Delegate Mark Levine have both said they plan to run.
Margaret Barthel reporting. Finally today, University of Virginia astronomer Kelsey Johnson takes us to the edge of scientific understanding about the universe in her new book that explores the biggest questions in cosmology and what we still don't know. Kelsey is our guest for Books and Brews tomorrow night at 7 at Pale Fire Brewing in Harrisonburg. WMRA's Chris Burrows asked Kelsey about her early love of the night sky as a child.
For me growing up, actually, the dark sky was the norm. I spent a lot of time outside. I can't remember a time in my life before I would have seen a dark sky. And so there wasn't ever really a first time that I can remember. It was just always there. And so it was baked into my reality of what being outside was and what the universe was.
How do you, as a UVA astronomer, decide what to study? I mean, is it a collective decision made by the department, or do you just go, I think this month it's black holes?
Oh, fun. A lot of it starts with, of course, things you might be curious about. Some of it starts early in your career if you're working with a mentor or an advisor. you might not have much of a say in what your mentor or your advisor is working on. And that kind of sets you down on a path, right? Because then once you start building expertise in an area, you might get more curious about it, you learn more about it, and you kind of might start going in that direction. Any particular department you're in generally let you do what you want to do. I think there's not a lot of top-down micromanaging, except that, you know, you're expected to publish papers, you're expected to bring in grant money, and there are these expectations you need to meet. But outside of that, we actually have a lot of freedom to do things that we find compelling. And that is one of the greatest gifts of having the kind of job that I do.
How do you actually go about the research? I mean, are you using a high-power telescope on campus?
You know, as a little baby astronomer, when I was little, we actually went to, it was normal and expected that you would go to the observatory to take your observations. And that's this, you know, old school romantic version of astronomy. And it was lovely. We don't do that a lot anymore because most of our modern, really high powered telescopes, you know, some of these telescopes literally took billions of dollars to make. And much of the observing these days is done virtually or remotely, or it's scheduled. And also a lot of it is done remotely. It's more efficient. It's certainly more cost effective, but it is a little bit less fun because you don't get to get your hands on the telescope.
Is someone in your capacity as a university astronomer, are you able to access Hubble or James Webb? How does somebody do that?
You know, in principle, anyone could.
Oh.
The way it works is annually there we put in proposals, and when proposal season comes around, most astronomers in the world are pretty stressed out trying to write a proposal. So you write a proposal, and this proposal then goes to a committee of astronomers who evaluate it. So it's a very competitive proposal process, but it's, in principle, it's not limited to people who work in universities or astronomical institutions.
As personal enjoyment, do you ever still go out with like a personal telescope and just have fun, or are you kind of beyond that at this point?
Oh, are you kidding me? The day that I don't get joy from looking at the night sky is the day that I should get a different career. There's just such a profound connection with the universe. Mm. And as many times as I have seen the night sky, I don't think I could ever get sick of it. And if I did, that would mean I had lost my spark and lost my curiosity. You know, I would challenge anyone listening, if you find, it doesn't even have to be a pristine dark sky. That's hard to reach from where we live in Virginia. But even a relatively dark night sky, and you go out at night and you let yourself just be there and look at it, if that doesn't do something special to your brain and your emotions and your sense of self, then I'm not entirely sure that you're human.
Yeah.
I think it's a really powerful experience to be able to really let yourself absorb and sink and bask in this unfathomable universe that we're a part of.
Yeah, I've always said that if you aren't interested in space, like, what's wrong with you? You know, I look up often and just am in awe. Like, I look at that star and go, wow, you are so far away that you might not even still be alive right now, because this, you know, the light we're seeing is from millions of years ago, right? So
yeah.
It's just, I'm blown away by the whole thing.
You know what? One thing that really worries me, and I'm going to share this candidly, I worry that it's actually really easy for people in modern life to even forget
yes.
that we are part of a much bigger universe.
Yeah.
And when we forget that we are part of something so much bigger than ourselves, and we're this tiny little fleeting speck, both in space and time, I think it's easy for us to be really myopic, not see the long term, inflate small things that don't really matter. I'm not a psychiatrist or a psychologist, and I shouldn't pretend to be one, but I worry about what it does to human psychology to not remember we're part of something so much bigger.
You could be the first astronomer psychologist.
Astropsychology. I think we've invented a new field.
That's UVA astronomer Kelsey Johnson. Her new book is called Into the Unknown, and she is our guest for Books and Brews tomorrow night at 7 at Pale Fire Brewing in Harrisonburg. To hear a longer version of the conversation, and to get details about tomorrow's event, visit WMRA.org. For WMRA News, I'm Bob Levicki. Thanks for listening, and I hope you enjoy your Monday.